This is Topical Fever, the show that takes a deeper, perhaps stranger look at some of the major issues defining our era. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 3 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons. My guest today is Claudia Moreno Pisano, who's not only an assistant professor of English, but also my wife. Claudia and I get to talk about all sorts of interesting things, and I hope that she'll come onto the show whenever I can convince her to come into the studio and talk into a microphone. And when I say studio, I mean the extra room we've got in the back. Claudia has a lot of expertise, and she has a lot of knowledge on a whole range of things, but I brought her in today to talk about childbirth. A lot of you might be wondering, what's political about childbirth? And I might have wondered the same thing a few years ago, but in the experiences that I've had with people close to us and the conversations I've had with Claudia over the years, I've really opened my eyes about how politicized childbirth and the practice of labor has become. We just had a national election that had a typically embarrassing and offensive engagement with women's issues, locating most of it around birth control and abortion, which are obviously incredibly vital issues to women and to men, to everybody. But childbirth often is not discussed in the actual practice of labor. So in this conversation, we talk about the medicalization of childbirth. We talk about cesarean sections. We talk about alternative practices like home birth and the kinds of things developed by hippie communes like The Farm in Tennessee, which has some incredible developments in terms of moving forward the conversation around childbirth. So I hope you enjoy this hour of Topical Fever. So, Claudia, you're the oldest of 3 kids in your family. And so, I mean, you have a little bit of years between those kids, your parents do at least. And so I imagine that your first experiences with childbirth were watching your mother go through that experience.
Yes. I was 7 when my first sister was born, and I was 14 when my second sister was born. And so my first sister, I was still pretty young, and I remember my mom being pregnant. And I remember visiting my mom in the hospital, and I have a very vivid memory of my grandma running down the hallway to tell me that she had been born.
Did they explain it to you? I remember because I had a niece that was born in 1985, so I guess I was about 7 years old, about the same age. And I don't feel like, when I remember it, it just seems like this blurry kind of medical thing.
Oh, yeah,
I went
totally
to the hospital and.
Yes.
And that was that. So is that first memory similar to you? Blurry?
Yes, it's blurry, and it's definitely medical. My mom...
Was it scary?
Yes, because my mom was going to the hospital, and my mom was getting a cesarean. My mom... mm-hmm. So when my mother was pregnant with me, the plan was not to be cesarean, but it's sort of unclear to me what happened, but she went into the hospital. My dad was not with her because at that time, dads didn't necessarily stay around the hospital. They would call you later, right?
Which is a weird thing in and of itself. But we'll talk about that when we get to the culture of childbirth in a second here.
Exactly. And so I guess what happened is that she developed a fever, mm-hmm. and they were afraid of infection. And so, as the story goes,
this is with you being born.
This is with me. Okay. Right. So this is because this explains what happened
long ago
later.
In the 1940s. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. The 1930s. Maybe.
Right. Okay. So
she develops a fever. The doctor calls my dad and mm-hmm. says that your wife has a fever. There's a chance of infection. We need to do a cesarean. We need your permission to do a cesarean. So you want to talk about weird. They call and ask my dad.
Your mom was conscious
at
this time.
My mom was conscious.
But they still had to call her husband to get permission to do something medical to her.
Yes. And my dad says, I had no idea that she was conscious. I thought she was like passed out and dying. So he's like,
right.
Of course,
yeah,
do whatever
right.
you need to do. Turns out she's right there. They get his permission. She has a cesarean with me. So...
And once you have that history, it seems like they always want to do a cesarean.
Yes,
right?
It's called VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, meaning that we don't do it, or we try not to do it. And this is a medical issue. This is a malpractice insurance issue more than anything else.
So go back a little before we get into that, because I wanted to hear a little bit about when you were 7 years old, because I feel like that's such a weird age to go through. So and yet it must be a very normal thing, because so many children obviously are born with siblings that are already 7, 8, 6, you know. And so there's this weird kind of consciousness about it. And did you know, like, the difference between a cesarean and a vaginal birth during this time at all?
I
don't think I knew the biology of how it worked. I mean, I feel like I didn't figure that out really till I was, like, 20 or 21. But either way.
Yeah. Excuse me. I didn't know the biology of it, but I knew that my mom wasn't going to do the pushing thing, that it was scheduled, and that she would be going to the hospital. My point of talking about me being born in cesarean, and at that time, especially because even now, if you've had a cesarean, hospitals are very, very reluctant, at least until very recently, and this is even true not in some hospitals, to allow you to try to have birth vaginally after you've had a cesarean. So for my mom, for the next two girls, it was a definite, it was just absolute, of course we're going to schedule a cesarean, even though it turns out that's not necessarily...
It's almost like by law.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it is pretty much by law in terms of medical malpractice for insurance, for hospitals.
So they don't want to do it because they think that there's at least a perception that there's a risk of complication.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So at seven, it was scary because I knew my mom was going to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And scary because there was a new baby coming around. But yeah, mostly it's blurry. And I don't remember how long my mom was in the hospital. I remember visiting her in the hospital with my dad and my grandma. And I don't remember much about when she came home.
It's funny you say the pushing thing, because now I realize how much the quote-unquote pushing, dramatic kind of labor is a part of our culture. It seems like almost every sitcom eventually does a hysterical childbirth scene.
Yes.
Movies always go to, you know, childbirth scenes in order to amp up drama. It's always this thing that I was always aware of. I guess I didn't know what water breaking was, maybe, but I feel like maybe sitcoms educated me a little bit on it.
Oh my God. I would say sitcoms miseducated you.
Miseducated. Yeah, fair enough.
Because that's exactly what it is. All those words you use, hysterical.
You mean people don't usually give birth, you know, stuck in elevators with like a wacky neighbor?
No, not usually. You use the word hysterical. You use the word, you said drama, to amp up the drama, tension.
It's a great device.
It's, of course.
Every actress wants to do the childbirth scene.
You think so?
Well, from what I understand, maybe that's a Hollywood cliche.
Yeah.
But there's a sense that every actress, you know, eventually gets to do that like intense childbirth scene. If you remember, I mean, the one in... one of the ones that's most memorable to me, because they did it so well, and it's such a cliche of a scene, but in 6 Feet Under with Brenda giving birth at the end.
Oh, right, right.
And you know, I don't want to spoil the show for people, but it's there are ghosts present during the birth, and it's just a really tremendous and dramatic thing. But at the same time, it's a very, you know, it's kind of a cliche. But anyway, I wanted to talk about your second sister being born,
right.
The youngest, who you would have been 14.
Yes.
So how is that experience different? Because obviously you're now at this point, I mean, the difference between 7 and 14 in terms of biological awareness is vast. So,
yeah.
So what was that like?
I think at that point I understood more what the cesarean was, and I, like everyone else, basically internalized, like, oh, of course, my mom gets a cesarean because she's already had cesareans, and that's what will happen. I know that birth was, my dad got to be present for that one. And so this was a big shift. It's the only one that I think he was actually in the operating room. Operating room is a terrible way to have
right,
a baby,
right.
But you know, there you go. And I remember my mom, I remember her being pregnant more than when I remember her being pregnant with my first sister. She was, you know, and I remember my youngest sister much more as a baby because I was older. But in terms of the pregnancy itself, 14 is still kind of young, you know? I understood more what was happening, and I think I was probably less afraid because I knew why my mom was going to the hospital, and I had more of a sense of what was going to happen. And because cesarean and the medicalization of birth has become so normalized, it didn't occur to me that I should be afraid. That didn't occur to me until much later when I experienced, when I was in a delivery room with a person I know and watched a medical childbirth,
right.
And then realized that it actually actually is far more terrifying like that.
Right, right. And we'll get, I want to get to that experience, because I think that's the moment where you began to think even you know, more seriously about what childbirth is and yeah. And kind of the politics of it. But you know, that word, even that word cesarean, what do you know the etymology of that? Why do they call it, what do they associate it with Caesar?
You know, I don't know.
Because I know that a Caesar salad usually has anchovies and, you know, Parmesan cheese and a certain kind of dressing.
Are you kidding me?
And I just, I don't see the connection.
I don't know.
It's weird though. Caesar is a salad. Caesar is a haircut. Caesar is a way of delivering a baby.
Caesar was...
I'll look that up.
A ruler. I'll look that up. Yeah, and I don't know what his deal was, but I can tell you that the cesarean is a really traumatic major surgery that we don't really talk about.
And you talk about it being normalized. I mean, it's beyond normalized. What I was reading, and I think you've obviously read a lot more about this, and I want to hear about what you've read, but it's... A lot of people don't know how prevalent this practice is. It's a 1 in 3 mm-hmm. Deliveries of babies, yes. live births in the United States, or actually North America, are cesarean. Yes. Which is, you know, my perception of cesarean always when I was younger, and I, you know, I know very little about this. This is kind of why I wanted to do this show, is because I want to. I feel like I'm not the only one that's really actually shockingly ignorant about how human beings are born in the United States and how you can locate so much of our politics, just like you can in food or anything else, in the way that practice is developing and how it's developed over the years. So we're at the age, Claudia and I, where we're experiencing a lot of you know, friends and family members having babies, and I think, you know, anyone who's in their late 20s to 30s to 40s is going to see your Facebook page filling up with pictures of babies, and it's kind of that it's part of
it's baby time.
It's baby time in our lives right now. So I think it's become something that's much more in my face in both literal ways and in the media and everywhere else, social media everywhere else, that I've been thinking about it. But you've had a couple experiences with people close to you that changed your perception of childbirth, I think, even more. I think maybe this is the first time since your mom giving birth when you were 14 years old, this is the first period in your life where there's been such an active engagement with childbirth. So you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah,
what is it that started this?
This is the first time that I've even, I mean, around, you know, being in my 30s, this is the first time I'm even thinking about babies in any way really at all, right? I've always been concerned with human rights and with women's rights and with the laws around women's bodies that govern women's bodies. But I hadn't really thought about it in terms of childbirth. It starts, I guess, a few years ago with a good friend of mine, who I'll call Sarah, who started having children while we were friends. And she is... both of her children, she has given birth at home with a midwife.
Which, and I want you to describe, I want to talk about this, but I just want to intervene for a second, because when I first heard this, and I think a lot of people hear this, and maybe you're hearing this, listening to this show, you know, one of the 5 people that listen to this show, maybe you're hearing this and thinking, wow, giving birth at home, like, you know, just in your bed or on the floor or something like that, sounds really, really... almost transgressive. It sounds like and when I began thinking about it and began investigating, hearing what you have relayed to me, mostly, it's a lot more complicated than that. So what has that been like?
Yeah, that's the word transgressive you use is literally right. So if I say home birth, people immediately think that you're crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy vegan thing to do, right? It's like, I mean, and I say that, and I mean that, I don't mean that to be condescending. I mean that as home birth is associated with a whole range of kind of radical living alternatives that are, I would say, in mainstream culture, very much made fun of.
Yes.
You know,
hippy dippy.
Despite those things kind of being ripe for parody on shows like, you know, Portlandia or whatever. I guess lay this down on the show before we start talking about this is, you know, those making fun of those practices is easy, but those practices are, in many ways, represent some of the only ways that people are resisting some really nasty, dominant mainstream practices, mm-hmm. With regards to food, with regards to how they live, with regards to body, etc. So we may have a little humor about home birth and veganism, etc. like that. But I have to, you know, identify that as a pretty gross cultural stereotype, because a lot of this stuff is really, really important. So what, yeah. What is a home birth?
Okay,
let's normalize home birth, because
because
the fact that cesarean is normalized and home birth is not, it's kind of unfair. So what
The step back for a second here and thinking about what birth is, right? Birth is literally a normal physiological process, not a medical process. It is only a medical process, or should be only a medical process, under extreme circumstances when it's called for, right? So if you look at
what we call complications,
right? Illnesses, high risk pregnancies, high risk birth, instances where things are actually going wrong, right? The key is knowing when something is going wrong and not making the jump and assumption that it is. So there's a lot of assumptions happening. There's a lot of things that go on. If we look at the history here, right? So if I say home birth, lots of people say, but isn't that dangerous, mm-hmm. right? Didn't women die in childbirth before the hospitals?
Right.
That's the question
people
ask us.
Right. There's one of the, and people look around their houses and they see, you know, a bunch of like Pringles containers on the floor and Taco Bell wrappers and stuff. And they're like, how could I give birth at home? It's a filthy place. And a hospital is a clean place.
Right.
And that leads to the bigger kind of cultural idea, which is that, maybe you could speak to, which is that, yeah, didn't women used to die in childbirth at home all the time?
Not all the time. Yes and no. And, you know, the history that you're referring to, the history that most Americans or people who grew up acculturated to Western cultures and I don't mean West like Europe, because in Europe, the primary mode of delivering babies is with midwives, not with obstetricians. In America, when you talk about home births and you have this vision of women dying in childbirth and infant mortality rates are being excessively high, this comes really specifically from the 19th century. Mm. And there's a few reasons for it. One of the reasons is that, and it has to do with women's bodies, and it has to do with general health and nutrition. So
everybody was unhealthy in the 19th century.
Well, to a certain degree, yes. One of the things that illnesses that run really high in the 19th century is rickets, mm-hmm. Which is not the case anymore. Now, rickets, one of the things that can happen is that it messes with your bones, that women's pelvi, I don't mm-hmm. know, right? That the woman,
I'm comfortable with either.
At the woman's pelvis, was far more frequently deformed and there was something wrong because she had rickets. She had vitamin C deficiencies. She had vitamin D deficiencies. This makes bones brittle, and this misshapes your pelvis, therefore making you in a position where giving birth is actually difficult and actually sometimes impossible.
So childbirth was more dangerous in the 19th century, not necessarily because of the lack of Western medicine,
right.
but an overall lack of cleanliness.
Yes. The other thing, right? A second kind of thing that that midwives knew before, and that with the takeover of physicians taking over women's work, is that physicians didn't put gloves on and they didn't clean their hands. Midwives previously did. And so, yes, you have infection. If you have frequent vaginal examinations during pregnancy, particularly after the water is broken or to break the water, you create infection with dirty hands. This is common in the 19th century. The other major thing that people don't think about, and it's tied to the kind of the stereotype of the fainting Victorian woman, mm-hmm. right? Well, you know why she faints? She faints because she's wearing an incredibly tight corset that's
right.
made of whalebone that she can't breathe in.
Right.
The other thing that the corset does is it literally misshapes your organs and it misshapes your bones, therefore making giving birth an impossible situation. So yes, women died more frequently, but it's not a worldwide necessarily historical thing. When Americans talk about it and they have that stereotype in mind, it's this very particular time that this is coming from.
Yeah, and it gives you the idea that, because, you know, I watch a lot of old westerns and like and, you know, and 19th century stuff, and it's always you know, wife's dead, you know, wife died in childbirth, and it's like it's a constantly, you know, this is what the characters are going through. Yeah. That it seems like there's a dead wife always with these characters, and it gives you the impression that childbirth is an extremely dangerous thing. And thank God we have modern medicine and modern science to kind of make sure that women don't die in childbirth, which would happen all the time.
Okay,
it's not true, though, right?
It's like, not true.
These complications don't really exist at the level to match the hysteria.
Exactly.
About it.
And actually, let me speak to those numbers that you're right. Let me give you some numbers. You're talking about how we think that maternal mortality has dropped with Western medicine. Well, let me read you these numbers from. This is as of 2009. So this is maternal mortality rates per 100,000 live births by race and ethnicity. So 34% non-Hispanic blacks more likely to die. 169% more American Indian Alaska natives likely to die. 11 Asian Pacific Islander, 10.4 non-Hispanic white, 9.6 Hispanic. So you're looking at tremendous numbers of maternal mortality that have everything to do with class and race in America, and that women are actually dying at incredible rates, way higher than we should, quote unquote, be dying according to the Western medicine that we have.
Right.
Those numbers are, there's a myth that Western medicine has solved this problem.
Right. And that myth is deeply political. And it's something that we'll probably, you know, come up on different shows. I imagine Justin would have something to say about this, because I imagine, you know, one of the quotes that I remember at the end of Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent, the documentary, he talks about the infant mortality rate in the United States being much higher than most people would expect, and that the United States is actually quite high on the list of in terms of infant mortality. And he talks about that number is such a great indicator of the overall health of a society. And the fact that the United States has such a high infant mortality rate,
it's 12.7 out of every 100,000,
is what he identified it as, a crime. Mm-hmm. With the amount of wealth that the United States has to have an infant mortality rate that high is criminality. And there's I think a lot of people don't understand why this infant mortality rate exists, or what it even how it even connects. But obviously it does have a lot to do with class.
It has to do with access. Okay.
And so what does that mean when I say okay, women, from lower social classes, you know, are unable to get access to what they need in order to give safe birth. What does that mean?
And the thing is that
practically, what does that mean?
Practically what that means is that women who do not have access. And here's the thing. I don't mean access to hospitals. I mean access to care. This is the general problem here, is that studies have shown over and over and over again, experience has shown over and over and over again, that women who have dedicated caregivers the entire time they're pregnant have a far higher chance of having a healthy pregnancy and a healthy birth and a healthy baby.
Well, this is you know, much bigger than childbirth, but you can locate it so strongly there. But you know, the idea that we don't really do healthcare in the United States. We talk about healthcare. We're really talking about insurance. Yeah, we're talking about insurance. We're talking about hospitals. We're talking about like specific institutional things we've created that have nothing to do with care. And everything that we've learned about that. I want to get back to the home birth thing, because I think a lot of people are still like, okay, what the hell does that mean? That means like, okay, your water breaks, get in bed, you have someone there. Walk me through a little bit of what this is like. because I think we have this ingrained image of, okay, water breaks, call the husband at work, you know, we're going to go to the hospital, and then there's going to be a couple hours of screaming and yelling, and then we'll have the baby's ass will get slapped by the doctor, we'll all smoke cigars, and that'll be it.
Yeah.
But like, when you're giving birth at home, you know, things are much different.
Yes.
And obviously they're different than a sitcom in the hospital too. But what is it? What does it mean when you give birth at home? What happens when your water breaks?
Let's go back to the sitcom for a second, right? Because the sitcom says, first of all, it has the order because you've said it too. What happens when your water breaks? So in the sitcom, the water breaks, and then there's a mad rush, and then there's a lot of screaming, and then there's a baby, right? And it seems to happen just one on top of the other. So let me tell you what really happens, right? And it's not the same for all women, but generally speaking, it is a longer, slower process that requires time and patience and care. So when you first start having your early labor, what's the first stage of labor? The first stage of labor can take hours. It can take a couple of days. It can stop and it can start again, and then it can stall and it can go away and then come back again 3 or 4 days later, right?
Oh, so the God, I don't know how people go through this.
See this, but you see, this is exactly what I mean. That attitude is exactly what it is, because we are like, we don't do this. Get this.
We don't suffer.
We don't suffer. We don't have time for this. I don't have time. My job is too
busy.
Maybe
we'll do a show on death eventually too. But I mean, hospice death is how we do death too.
Right.
And like most Americans, and I think not just Americans, but you know, Western people, maybe it's prevalent around the world, but I think it's especially true in America, that when you get to a certain stage of moving towards death, you don't you go to a hospice and you fill yourself with morphine, or you have a nurse fill you with morphine for, you know, 9 days, 14 days. Mm-hmm. You're completely out of it, and you just die without even noticing, really.
Right.
And that's another topic, but it's indicative of the problem that's related to birth too.
Which a lot of it is about time, right?
But it's also about using medicine, you know, just kind of using medicine to supersede natural processes.
Right. Yes.
Like, I don't want to feel pain, so just give me an epidural and pull the baby.
But here's the thing, that actually puts it on, that it's more complicated than that, because it's a lot of times women are not asking for pain medication or to be induced or to be sped up when they are in a hospital setting. But hospital protocol, which is something else aside from the home birth, right? Hospital protocol requires that, or pushes that, or bullies the mother to be into that, where she doesn't necessarily want that. Lots of women find themselves, they want to give birth in a hospital or birthing center because they feel like, well, just in case, I'm very close, there's a doctor nearby. But the thing is that once you step foot into the hospital, it is already medicalized, and things like that are taken out of your hands.
Automatic process that happens.
Yes, absolutely. So if, let's go back to home, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're starting to have contractions. They start slowly, they start mildly, your cervix starts to open slowly, right? Generally speaking, especially for a first birth, a first-time mother, this is a very, very slow process. During the first stage of labor, mother-to-be takes a nap, she takes a shower, she eats, she walks around. One of the ways to alleviate pain of cramps, and women who, you know, have had their periods and have suffered from cramps, they know this. You lay in different positions, you roll over, you put your knees up, you take a hot bath, you take a hot shower. You drink tea. There's all kinds of things that you should be able to do with your body, freedom of movement, as well as having someone nearby, whether it's your midwife or your partner or your sister or your doula, who says, I'm with you. I'm hanging on. We're riding this together. It's all good. Nothing is wrong. And we're just doing this. And it's a slow, easy process.
Can you explain really quickly the terms midwife and doula?
The midwife is, she is generally certified. She can be a nurse practitioner, or she can be a certified practicing midwife. Different states have different laws about that. But in all states, midwives have to be attached to a physician at some point, for in case of there is a medical emergency.
And what about a doula?
And so the midwife is...
How do you spell doula, by the way?
D-O-U-L-A.
Okay.
So the midwife is the woman who will actually deliver your baby. Or no, you will deliver your baby, right? This is the other thing. Birth is not something that happens to you in the medical method of care. Birth is something that happens to you. In the midwifery model, you give birth. It is an active process that the woman gets to do. The midwife is the woman who will literally help you through that, and who knows the medical, and who has hands on and is helping you deliver the baby. The doula, a doula can be, it's a doula, the word is it's a Greek word that initially means something like slave or servant. And so it's it's a little bit tricky that the word was adopted, but nonetheless, what it means is that she is the woman who stays with you from the very beginning. Your midwife generally doesn't show up for those first few hours.
So the doula is like an emotional support,
yes,
kind of.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, she's also in a hospital.
We call it bedside manner in Western medicine, which is really lame.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, obviously.
There's everything to be said for
everything
it.
To be said for hand-holding, things like that. It's really amazing, like, how... I don't know, intransigent the dominant narrative is with regards to these kinds of things. So like the New York Times, I think, did an editorial recently where they're like, oh, they were like, you know, like it was this big revelation that people who are dying, that if you like hold their hand, mm-hmm. they feel a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, you know, science doesn't bear this out. There's no way we can prove this on, you know, with graphs and statistics.
Yes.
But, you know, some weird people in other countries tend to do this.
For thousands of years.
And maybe it helps. And it seems like it's always like that with indigenous mm-hmm. knowledge.
Absolutely.
And always like that with non-Western knowledge. It's kind of like, oh, well, maybe they might be onto something. We still got to go check it out in the lab and make sure.
Exactly.
Which is something that I really, really resent about Western science, and that's something that we, you know, will obviously come up a lot. The idea that Western science is this is the normal,
is what's right
and what's normal, and any deviation from that has to be looked at with deep skepticism, and obviously different levels of racism and ethnocentrism and xenophobia.
Yeah.
But either way, so when you're giving birth at home, for those of you who are planning to give birth at home soon. You need a midwife. You don't do it like on your own.
Some women do.
Just by yourself.
Some women do. There's controversial. I thought. Okay, it's a point of controversy.
Are there laws about this? Are you allowed? I mean, I'd be fascinated to know because.
Well, I think.
And the reason I want to say because you know I talked about this a little bit in my introduction, but you know this. We talked a lot about in the last election. When I say we. I mean the mainstream media talked a lot about. Women and, mm-hmm. and they located most of women's rights and women's issues in the topic of birth control and access to birth control, which is and a little bit, you know, obviously access to abortion is part of that. But at the same time, it's interesting to see that, you know, I think those issues are obviously, you know, vital issues to talk about when you're talking about women's rights. But at the same time, childbirth itself has all these legal
political and
practical aspects embedded into it as a practice that are you know worthy of discussion as well and worthy of investigation because I wanted to know maybe you don't mm-hmm. know the answer to this. Are there laws about giving birth at home? Are you allowed to just do this?
You are well, women do, right? And sometimes women do accidentally because it happens. You give birth, and then mm-hmm. most women will then go to a hospital and et cetera, et cetera. You are allowed to give birth with a midwife. The laws, I can't speak to the exact law, but I do know of cases where women have refused care, and then the hospital will take an immediate court order against her as the baby's lawyer in order to deliver the baby by the way that they want to mm-hmm. deliver them, and that will show up at your house while you're trying to give birth. There's a couple of instances of this. There is, hold on a second while I find her name. There are really great details about this in a book called Pushed by mm-hmm. Jennifer Block that has tons of good statistics. And I don't want to spout statistics because I don't have them at the tip of my fingers. But she's
and
a
no
really
one,
great
no one likes
reference.
Statistics either. Anyway.
So let me go back a second because I just want to finish that kind of arc of what was happening. Right. So the midwife doesn't show up right away. She shows up later in the home birth situation. When you are starting to what's called transition into second stage,
mm-hmm.
She probably shows up before that, but the transition into second stage is contractions start to come much quicker, and things are your cervix is dilating it's opening much, much at a much quicker rate, preparing for baby to come out.
And this is happening, what, while you're just walking around still?
You might be walking around.
Laying in bed?
You know what? It's different for everybody. It totally depends. You're probably not.
And can you talk about, because I remember we were talking about the whole lying down on your back
yeah,
thing.
You don't.
Because that's another thing that's like, in terms of the sitcom, I mean, the whole,
oh
it's
my
always,
God,
there's
yeah.
never a different position. It's no. always a woman
on
kind
her
of
back.
Laying back, pretty much with her legs in stirrups.
Yeah.
Screaming in some
yeah, of
weird
course. She's screaming because
kind of
she's
missionary
laying
position
on
so,
her back. Yeah,
right.
she, oh exactly. It
right.
is. It is totally a
Which
missionary
is, you
position.
Know, supplicant kind yeah. of feminine thing. But okay, so
she's lying on her back, she's gonna have a really hard time giving birth because
what are
she's
the other
working
ways
against gravity.
That you could give birth?
You can squat, mm-hmm. you can sit up. Lots of people give birth lots of women give birth sitting up, supported either against their partner or against a couch or against a stool. Mm. Some women give birth sitting up. They used to call them birthing stools. Mm-hmm. There's lots of they make these big giant balls. They look like gym balls where you sit on them and you can kind of bounce on them so that you're supported as you sit. Mm.
Squatting. People do it in the bathtub.
Yes,
lot
you
too.
Can do not. You probably wouldn't in your like enamel bathtub
right.
in the bathroom, but you can get a birthing tub
uh-huh.
that you fit.
That's
so, it's more like
a
kiddie pool.
Sanitation issues?
No, it's more for comfort.
Oh, okay.
It's literally like it's bigger. Yeah. I mean, apart you know, especially if you live in an apartment, you know, with a hard enamel bathtub, mm-hmm. it's more like a kiddie pool and it's softer and you can control the temperature of the water, and you can do a water birth. And
it just seems so counterintuitive to people. I think that to just give birth at home and then it was like, wait, do you go to the hospital at the end, right?
No.
And make sure
yeah.
the baby's okay?
No, right? And the last position I was going to say is women very often give birth on their hands and knees,
mm-hmm.
That actually tends to be the most comfortable position, or lying on their side. Particularly if you if it's been a long process and you're starting to get worn out, to be laying down, but not to be lying on your back, to be sort of more on your side and supported so that you're kind of upright, so that you're not working against gravity.
Good Lord.
Well, it is intense.
It sounds intense.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes. It
is
intense.
And speaking of intense, I want to get to another experience, because you have. I mean, we always have this friend that you're talking about that does the home birth thing, and she's had two children now. She's having another very soon.
Yep.
And we'll also do home birth.
Yep.
The whole thing has been really successful. Mm-hmm. It's been not only like a wonderful and safe experience for them, for this couple to have their children be born in their home, but also it's been, hesitate to use the word spiritual, but it's been very almost, you know, psychedelic. It's been like very nourishing experience mm-hmm. for them to have
Absolutely.
The kids at home. And now the other kids are involved in it. And
mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it's just a tremendous and very, I don't know, organic kind of experience. And you know, you had someone else close to you, Julia, who we're calling Julia for the sake of anonymity, and the experience was very, very different. And it was you had a very medicalized experience,
mm-hmm.
and maybe you could talk about that and why. Because you know, I can say this. I know that Claudia is a very strong person. She's not someone who's easily shaken. She teaches a lot of classes. she's in front of crowds all the time, and I have a lot of confidence in her confidence as a person. But when I showed up at the hospital a few hours, maybe an hour after the birth had happened, the birth that that Claudia's going to talk about right now, the look on Claudia's face was very striking to me. She looked like she had gone through war. It was like she had gone through a really, really traumatic experience, and I knew from just looking at her that something difficult had taken place in that room just recently. So what was that like?
Yeah,
because it was like war. It seems like it was like a war experience.
Here's the thing. Okay, so before I answer that, let me just step back a second, because I can hear the sort of naysayers, out in the crowd, whatever the crowd is, right?
There's three or four
the three or
solid
four
listeners
who are naysaying or who are wondering, and the sort of at the almost idealistic tone that comes across from home birthers, right? And I'm one of them in terms of like belief in the possibility of home birth. I just want to say that midwives, right? Okay, so there's a place called, there's a midwife who, lots of people who are involved in this sort of know, her name is Ina Mae Garten. She's in her 70s now, and she's been a midwife since the 70s. And she has a place, there's a sort of it's a community called The Farm, right? And their rates are sort of insane. They're off the charts in terms of 2% cesareans, right? Is their rate, as opposed to the rate of 32.9% U.S. cesarean rate in 2009, right? The farm is consistently at 2%.
And for those that don't know, the farm is a hippie commune, and the farm is by far the largest and most successful of the hippie commune projects to emerge out of the early and to mid 1970s. Lots of those projects that, you know, it's a fascinating history, the whole commune thing. And also, I just want to point out another. Another thing, the hippie commune, that is consistently marginalized in our culture, usually by, you know, making fun of these types of people. But the numbers that regarding childbirth that the farm has had are pretty stunning.
Yes.
And, you know, I always have to point out when the hippies are right.
Yeah.
because in this case, especially, it's the numbers are tremendous.
Right. And so what I was going to say, what I'm leading to there is to sort of dispel the kind of overly romantic notion of home birthing, is that good midwives will know if something is actually wrong, and will have access to and get you to a place where the OBs are, obstetricians are actually necessary sometimes. And any midwife will know that. And she is, it's a sort of, I don't know, someone described it, I think it was Ina May Garten, described it as a physician versus a specialist, right? Mm. So you go to the physician for your general problems, and the physician says, look, this is a much more specialized thing. You've got this or this, and I'm not qualified, so I'm going to send you to this person, right? And so it's sort of steps in care, mm-hmm. and not steps, but levels in care, just sort of differences in care. And so midwives are not saying that they'll end all cure all, end all be all of just pregnancy. But what they do say is that most women, given good care and given education and knowledge and given the time and the space, to be relaxed about being pregnant, to be relaxed about childbirth. We're not relaxed. We're terrified.
Yeah,
right?
I mean,
we're terrified.
I'm glad you said that, because I don't want people to get the idea that we're advocating, or you're advocating, or I'm advocating. I'm really just trying to learn more about this, because I feel like it's not something that I've really thought about in terms of locating politics in before.
Yeah.
And you know, just like the food thing, you know, there's been this kind of I guess larger engagement in the public lately with food politics, and we're definitely going to do a show about that eventually. But it's just another one of those elements where you can find you can investigate the kind of larger society's assumptions and ideologies in this thing.
And I'll the hospital thing will illustrate this.
Yeah, and so in other words, I'm not, and I wouldn't say, you know, we're not saying that people shouldn't go to hospitals when to have babies. But I think that what we are saying is that the practice of normalizing the hospital experience as that being the base experience that everybody has is a really highly problematic thing, particularly when the home birth practice maybe should be the more go-to, normalized, and certainly more seems just, you know, on an intuitive level, it seems like I would want to be home. And I feel the same way, and a lot of people do about death, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't want to die in a hospital. You want to have this, like, transcendent experience in a really gray, clinical, cold,
terrifying
place where nobody really knows you, and a lot of it has to do with money.
Yeah.
Like tremendous money.
Yeah.
And so there's a feeling that the hospital experience, you know, should be avoided, and I feel like a lot of people feel that way. But there's practical and demonstrable reasons why the hospital experience is something that we ought to investigate as a culture.
Yeah.
But go ahead, because I want to get to your, because your hospital experience needs to be shared.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing, right? Okay. So the kind of back up a second. The larger problem is that we have been normalized, like we've been saying, to feel like birth is a scary thing, that it's a risky thing, that something could go wrong. When in reality, it's, as I opened up with, it's a normal physiological process that most women will do, and do it well, and just do it. It'll be long, and it will hurt, and it will be a struggle, but it will happen, right? And so the struggle of it is something that is, we've been taught to fear. We have been taught that something could possibly go wrong. Now, Some of this has to do, a lot of this has to do with malpractice insurance. Mm-hmm. So that hospitals are being put in a position where they are covering their asses, literally. They are, because they are afraid of, if a thing goes wrong in the small percentage that it might go wrong, quote unquote, then they have to cover themselves. And so they take all these steps to prevent that. When in the majority of healthy pregnancies, nothing is going to go wrong. Right. That's just the if you look at statistics, the statistics for you as a pregnant woman in a normal basic pregnancy are on your side. Mm-hmm. Right. But we're not taught that. We're told the opposite. OK, so Julia's experience. Now, the thing is, I'm saying hospital. Julia actually technically was in a birthing center.
Because she didn't want to be in a hospital.
No, she had a midwife.
She definitely didn't want to be a home birth, but she didn't want to necessarily go to the hospital.
Right. No. So what she was trying to do was find an in-between, which is what many women are trying to do. And so she had a midwife, and she gave birth in a birthing center, but it wasn't a freestanding birthing center, because those are actually very hard to find. Those are rare. And so what you more often have are birthing centers that are inside of a hospital, which means that you are inside of a hospital, and which means that you are automatically subject to hospital rules. So when we checked in, Julie's contractions were getting closer together, but she was still many hours away. But because it was her first birth, even though she later said, I knew it was too soon to go, but we were all kind of amped up and we weren't sure. And so we went. You know why
they had the sitcom. They had the sitcom emergency scenario in their head.
Well,
time to go.
Yeah. You know what it partly is too? It's the thing about not being cared for, because when your contractions are starting to get bigger, even though you're still kind of far away, you want someone nearby.
It's scary.
It's scary. And you need someone
there. And
there's
that hand-holding thing though. You don't need someone with a pack of IVs. You need someone just to sit with you.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, anyone who's experienced tremendous pain,
yes,
knows that.
Yes.
That morphine, great. You know,
right.
But at the same time, there's a tremendous help in having someone there with you
and that's,
connecting with you on a human level.
Exactly.
Speaking of hippy dippy, go ahead.
But it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
No,
these are
absolutely.
Things that are, these
and that's
are
not
things,
just hippy dippy. I mean, the hippies
bear
let's know that the hippies didn't make this stuff up. This is a lot of stuff that was gleaned from ancient indigenous practices, gleaned from Eastern medicine. Gleaned from a lot of different areas. So go on. So the contractions are getting worse. You're
right,
in the hospital and you're in this kind of like your birthing center.
Right.
You don't want to be in the hospital, but it seems like once you're there, they got you.
Oh, that's it.
And you're going to start getting into the web.
Okay, here we go. So the first thing you go is you go into the intake room, which is not the actual birthing room. And you're not quite in the center yet. You're in the intake. And your midwife gives you an exam and she tells you how dilated your cervix is, right? You're this many centimeters, you're this many centimeters. You're still pretty far
away.
Weird
that they're on the metric system, but
yeah.
Anyway.
Yes, even in America.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is she says, here are the hospital rules. First thing she says, and I have a distinct memory of this, and I partly have this memory because I walked away so that I wouldn't watch them do it because I'm sort of a baby like that, is that she said, you have to be hooked up to an IV the whole time you're here.
Mm.
Okay.
IV of what?
Okay. Initially, it's just fluids.
Yeah.
It's hydration. But the real reason that
saline
you're
or glucose.
The real real reason that you are hooked up is because they can give you Pitocin if they need to. Pitocin is artificial oxytocin that induces labor when it's taking, quote unquote, too long.
Pitocin is what they give you when they want to, quote unquote, induce labor.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Okay. And inducing doesn't mean that it happens right away. It's still a long process.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of risk to the Pitocin, but hospitals regularly use it. And you almost have no choice. You almost don't even know that it's happening
to
you.
What are the risks of Pitocin?
Well, Pitocin can make your contractions more painful. Mm. They can make labor last. The contractions much longer. They make the contractions come more quickly. Normal contractions give you a rest. There's a rush of contraction, and then even it's at the very end. Sometimes it's only like a minute that you get to breathe and relax. Pitocin stops that, and it increases the use of epidural because Pitocin has made your contraction so much more painful and quick that you now can't actually bear the pain, and now you're on an epidural.
That's and so the that second... just furthers the medicalization.
Yes. Right. It also, Pitocin has the, runs, you run the risk of your blood pressure going up. It can raise your blood pressure, which means it can raise the baby's blood pressure, which is a whole other set of problems.
Okay,
right?
So she's hooked up to the IV. Okay, you're, the a little, other... you're already a little disturbed by
this. Yes,
by
I am. I am, because there's already several people walking in and out. There are several nurses. The midwife has already stuck her fingers inside several times, and now they're sticking her with an IV. The other reasons that they say that you have to be on the IV is because that so that you don't get dehydrated, so that they can give you the Pitocin, so that if you do decide you want an epidural, the IV is already there, because you have to be hooked into the IV before you can have the epidural, because it runs through there and then to the to your back. And the, this is the, again, quote unquote, in case something goes wrong, right? So the assumption is that something will go wrong and we can't waste time hooking you up to an IV after the fact. We want you preemptively hooked in just in case something goes wrong. Now, here's...
So once again, it's kind of like operating on that larger cultural and erroneous assumption that something, quote unquote,
will
is
go
going
wrong.
To go
wrong.
And
so,
we,
you, of course...
so we have to, we have to create a insane structure of medical devices and medicine, etc.
Yeah.
In the case that, in the rare case that this happens.
Mm-hmm. So you
and
now
treat, and treat your whole. So it's like almost like your every pregnancy is treated like a complicated.
Yes,
pregnancy.
Of course it is. That it's exactly, you hit the nail on the head.
We have the thesis of the show.
Every pregnancy is treated like it's a complicated pregnancy when most are not. Mm. So when you're on the IV, I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital hooked up to an IV, right? It's in your hand or it's in your arm.
It's the worst.
Yeah, it's the worst. It's painful. It's irritating. The more you move, the
you
more
just
it hurts.
You want to rip it out constantly.
The more it irritates, because it's an irritating
presence.
You can
feel it under your skin.
It's also, so technically, you can walk around with an IV because you hold, you push the thing around. But who wants to once you've got the IV there? It's actually very difficult to hold the thing, to push it around with an IV while you're laboring. Now, one of the big things, like I mentioned before, in stage one of labor, is that it's really helpful to move around.
And you can, and the medicalization of this means you cannot walk around.
Right.
Yeah.
So now Julia.
That would bother me.
Now Julia is pretty much in bed.
Yeah.
She's in bed the whole time.
And that's how long is that process? How long was she in bed for?
She was in bed for. We checked in around midnight, I guess 11:30, 12, something like that. And she had the baby the next morning, almost 9.
So walk me through those 9 hours. I mean, you don't have to go into a lot of detail, but what was the arc of the experience here?
Right.
What are we talking about? Why was it so crazy?
So what happens is she's hooked up to the IV. We go into the birthing room, into the delivery room, and we hang out there. And Julia's contractions are getting worse and worse, and they're getting harder. And what I didn't realize then, but realized the next morning after looking at what was happening on the IV bag itself, is that they had started giving her the Pitocin in order to speed things up, quote unquote, because her cervix was too slow. It was dilating too slowly, and they anticipated that it was going to take too long. Now, this too long thing, this is the hospital talk, right? So her contractions are becoming unbearable. Like unbearable. She is not managing at all. I'm doing my thing. I'm helping her try to.
Is it like, is this the sitcom scene where she's like gnashing her teeth?
Yes.
And
yeah. She's not present anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
She's not even talking to you.
She's not talking. She's
just
gone
like
into
moaning,
another.
Screaming?
Yes. She's moaning and she's gone into another place.
Oh, Lord.
And partly it's.
I was not present for this, obviously.
No. And so some of that has to actually do, I realized later, has to do with the fact that she was being given the Pitocin. And so then she asks for an epidural. So I leave the room because no one can be present in the room while the epidural is being given. We get this whole spiel about how the epidural, all of these risks. And if anything goes wrong, she's going to be immediately taken to the emergency, you know, surgery, et cetera, et cetera. We come back and she's fine and she's hanging out. And she's herself again. And the midwife says, you should try to take a nap. And so she tries to take a nap. And she takes a nap. And the midwife comes back and says, it's time to start pushing. Now, here's the thing. Is that if you've been given an epidural, you can't feel when you're supposed to push. A woman, so this is the sitcom joke where it's like, push, 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 right? It's
everyone's
the whole,
everyone's
ordering, shouting at her to push. A woman giving birth who can feel
knows when to push.
She does not need to be told.
So if
because
I were,
she will actually, it'll be the opposite. She won't be able to not push.
So
you
if,
know?
If I were seeing things from a certain kind of perspective, a certain kind of feminist perspective, I might say that an epidural actually, you know, serves the bodily purpose or serves, at least on some level, the purpose of taking agency away from a woman and putting it in the hands of others.
It absolutely does.
And it's like, all of a sudden, now I'm telling you to push instead of you
knowing
when to push.
Yeah, you don't have to...
It's literally, I mean, I think that's probably my biggest problem with Western medicine. And, I'm not a hater of Western medicine. And if I, you know, break my arm, I'm going to the hospital. But
exactly.
But,
if you
yeah,
break
if
your arm.
If I break my arm. But the my biggest problem with Western medicine is that sense that... that you're not in control of your own body.
Yes.
And that it gets in the way of the natural processes. That your body actually is amazing, has an
yes.
amazing capacity for
yeah.
knowing, and I include this with your mind, but also on an intuitive level, knowing what's wrong and being able to do something about it.
And the thing, here's the thing about pain, right? I mean, you and I, we both have tattoos, and so we deal with pain with being in pain and knowing that that pain doesn't mean something is wrong is an entirely different thing than... I cut myself with a knife and I'm bleeding and I'm in pain and I know that I better get someplace because something is wrong. So if you sit through something like a tattoo, even though it hurts like hell, there are your brain doesn't run away from it in the sense of like panic. You're not panicking
right.
because you know that nothing is wrong because you know it's okay. Birthing pains are the same thing. They're a different kind of pain. They are the pain that says, well, I can ride them and I might be difficult, but I know that nothing is wrong. That's part of the presence of the midwife, because contractions can make you feel like you're like everything is just going to rip out and just explode. And she's there to say,
don't worry. But does
she's
epidural,
like, I've never seen anyone
explode.
Does
the epidural actually take pain away?
It's an anesthetic.
It numbs you. And so it's
also the lead into a cesarean, which
right.
is so high because all you really have to do once you've had the epidural, you just have to amp that up
and one of the things I don't want to interrupt the story, but one of the things that blew my mind is the kind of idea that doctors will do cesareans because they want it to happen quickly.
Yeah.
They're
absolutely.
Like, yeah. All right, we've pushed enough. I need to get to the golf course. Let's do a cesarean.
So
let's shorten this process.
What the obstetrician does is tell the woman that, well, one of the big myths is that your pelvis is not big enough for passing a baby. Women are terrified that they're too narrow, that their pelvic bones will not admit a baby through it, right? Because it seems impossible. But one of the things about the pelvis is that it's actually four separate bones that are connected by ligaments. It's not a solid ring of bone. This is super important because what that means is that the hormones that are released during contractions, during the birth process, means that the ligaments stretch. Everything stretches. And so the pelvis literally takes on a new shape.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually feel it.
That's why they can tell through skeletons whether women have given birth.
Yeah, yeah,
through
yeah.
Through
yeah.
the pelvic stretching. Is that true of everyone? Do men have pelvises that are in four parts that expand like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, the pelvis
too?
Is always that. The pelvis.
I really wish
you
hadn't brought that up because I don't want to. That's something I would rather not know. I was kind of secure in my. I was secure in my
ring, solid ring
pelvis,
of bone.
Yeah, pelvis as pelvis as one piece. And I was comfortable with that.
If the pelvis was one piece, if it was a ring of bone, then yes, we would have far more trouble. The other thing that happens is that the baby's skull, right? You know, the baby comes out and you have to be careful because there's a soft spot.
It's a cone head.
Yeah. Well, no. But that's the thing is that a baby's skull inside has not, it's in pieces that has not fused together. So the bones reshape as they're passing through the birth canal and then reshape back into normal circle size style, you know, when she's out.
So when the midwife came back and said to you to Julia to start pushing after the nap, what was this the middle of this, like 2 or 3 in the morning or something?
No,
like
this is already this is morning.
Eight in the morning,
7:30 or 8 or something like that.
So this last push was like what, an hour?
Almost two
hours.
And the and some women, even under normal circumstances, will push a long time.
So what was it that made your face turn ghostly white?
I think
what was it about this?
The whole, I don't know. I think it was all of this, and then leading up to partly it was me not being fully educated, and that's my own fault. And that's, again, the misplaced trust we have that doctors are just going to take care of things, where I actually feel like I should have known a lot more about the actual birthing thing.
So yeah, it's actually
when it happens.
This experience wasn't like so terrible that you realize that hospitals are horrible places.
No.
It was more, I think, an experience for you that raised a lot of questions.
Yes.
You're like, is this? I think you came back from the experience saying at the hospital saying, is it always like this?
Yes.
Is it supposed to be?
Yes.
Is it supposed to be that way? Or is there another way?
Right.
Because we have this friend that's obviously doing the home birth. And I think it made you think like, wow, now I understand
why she did
the quote unquote hippies do the home birth, because they're trying to avoid some really uncomfortable, unnecessary, like monstrous stuff. And they want to have control of their own lives too.
And their baby's lives.
Right.
And so the final stage in this is the baby is she's born. Right. Now, when you're in a hospital or birthing center, what happens is that the midwife picks the baby up and puts her on Julia's belly for just, I don't know, not even a minute, right? And but before she even does that, she's suctioning her nose. Now, here's a big myth, and I looked this up because this was a big question.
So many myths here.
This was a question for me. I was like, well, doesn't somebody need to suction the baby's nose? The answer is usually not.
What about slapping its ass?
No.
No.
No. You don't know. The midwife didn't do that.
That's just a cultural tradition.
Right, exactly. Well, I don't even think that midwives or doctors do that anymore. At least I hope not. But the suctioning, in most cases, the baby will, if the baby is born vaginally, the contractions of the uterus help to clear the baby's lungs of amniotic fluid. Mm-hmm. So that by the time the baby is out, she can take her first breath. It can take a few seconds, and that was something I didn't know. But in most cases, she doesn't actually need anybody to suction out. In cases where she does, if you've left the mother alone and not touched the baby, the mother will do it herself. She'll do it with her mouth and it will be fine. But the baby will take her first breath. But after giving the baby to Julia for a very brief amount of time, they take the baby away and they put her on the warming table and they start running tubes down her nose and tubes down her throat. And my instinct was something is wrong.
Right. Once again,
what is all this?
Like, yeah,
what is
like
all this?
Something.
And they leave Julia alone.
There's a loud beeping in the room.
Yes,
nurses running around.
The midwife.
We have a code for beep,
yes,
beep,
that's,
beep.
The midwife calls, okay, blah, blah, code for blah, blah. And a team runs in with a table.
Oh, believe me. And in the few experiences I've had with people close to me in the hospital, there's a kind of constant air of panic and insanity in the hospital. The few times that I've visited people in the hospital, but over the course of days, I begin to feel very, very bad about being in the hospital.
Yes.
It's a tremendous. It's beyond the kind of depressing bureaucracy that you experience in, like, say, the DMV or other horrible institutional places. The hospital is a place where you actually feel like you might die.
Yeah,
like you really feel like there's a really horrific undertone of what we're calling medicalization, but just of panic about the body, of like really rigid, scary relationship to our bodies. And it always makes me feel when I'm in a hospital that my body's not my own, that I don't control it, and that there are all sorts of the irony is that hospitals are tremendously unhealthy places in terms of the overall way that we approach our bodies.
Yes, exactly. So this whole first few minutes of this baby's life, she's taken away from her mother. She's weighed. She's pricked with a pin. She's got her footprints taken.
She's photographed. She's fingerprinted.
The whole right. They put the antibiotic ointment in her eyes, which I didn't know about, and I was like, "What are you doing? What's wrong with her eyes? Can she not see what's happening?" It turns out she doesn't really need that, but all hospitals do it, et cetera, et cetera. And then, finally, she's given back to Julia.
Mm.
And so by the time you come and see me and see this new baby and we go, I have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
And I laugh.
And can you say,
I'm laughing.
You're laughing, but that's true.
But it's actually true.
It's real.
Because that's what
You've been tested. You actually have. No.
No. But here's the thing, is that I felt that way. I felt like, you said, I felt like I'd been through war. I feel like I wept for like 2 days about this. I still feel vaguely traumatized about this. This is a few years ago already. Mm-hmm. And then I read and I started reading up all about this in the last couple of years. And it turns out that it actually is PTSD. It actually is post-traumatic.
And if I were a medical thinking person, I would say, how do you catch PTSD? Was there like a dirty sink there? How do you catch that?
So post-traumatic
stress.
What kind of
medicine from a giant pharmaceutical company can I take to cure it?
Exactly. So that all of that really made me start thinking about body in a bigger way than I had, thinking about women's bodies and thinking about childbirth as a political act, thinking about how it is an act of political transgression to give birth at home, as you
which
put
is
it
really
earlier.
I mean, to me, that I mean, whatever you think about home birth, the fact that we even think of it as transgressive, or, you know, most people would think, you know, wacky, insane, even dangerous, that's an indication of how far we've come from a more kind of organic and healthy relationship to ourselves as human beings. And, you know, certainly this has a lot to do with control of women, and that's why I wanted to talk about this today, is because you know, I feel like we talk about women's issues in such a limited way in the public square, you know, and mm-hmm. and that childbirth is actually a tremendous place for this to be located, and it has to do with everything else. I mean, it's really what we're talking about here is a move towards like a corporate, you know, a corporate kind of view of childbirth, of just kind of rack them up and knock them down kind of attitude towards it, which is all about, you know, cutting costs, efficiency. What you mentioned, malpractice insurance.
Oh, yeah. The malpractice insurance is killing hospitals,
this book that,
killing doctors. Yeah.
For those that are listening, the book that you're talking about is called Pushed. Is that right?
Pushed.
That's kind of one of the main books that you've read a couple. I know you've read a couple about this subject. But
Pushed is really great, especially for those of, not for those of you who are naturally skeptics, but just because it's full of numbers. It's full of the kind of the statistics of looking at specific hospitals, specific practices, looking at the history, the changing numbers of cesarean rates, of infant mortality rates, of maternal mortality rates and illnesses, et cetera, et cetera. And also looking at other places, because I wanted to say that in Europe and in places like Japan and China, midwifery is the standard. It's really only here that the standard is that you go to the hospital. And it makes me really sad that people like Julia feel like the thing is the process is something risky, and that they need that having a midwife or having a midwife at home is somehow unsafe.
There are many examples of that in our culture, though. I mean, people would often rather eat food that's been treated with pesticides because they think that's normal.
It's cleaner somehow or safer.
You know,
yeah.
Then, you know, a tomato that's been grown in someone's backyard is something that's scary. And there are certain, you know, there are so many of these really, really gross misperceptions that are hard to overcome because of the mainstream media. And when I say mainstream media, I don't mean necessarily like Fox News ramming it down your throat. It's kind of kind of cultural reality. We're talking about sitcoms.
Yeah.
Like that's how these things are. The ideology is transmitted in our culture. And that's how people begin to believe these really deeply ingrained myths.
Yeah.
So you read Pushed. And is there somewhere where people that are listening, like a website or something that people can go to, a resource to learn more about, like, midwife or what this is?
You know, I would recommend, you know, I think a lot of people think that she is, you know, we keep throwing around the word hippie, right? Is Ina May Garten.
Yes.
That she has several books that are full. She's very good. She has books full of statistics and resources.
And her name is Garten, Garten.
Yes. Yeah. Ina May Garten.
And look up The Farm on Wikipedia. Yeah. You could start there and begin investigating kind of how, you know, these marginalized alternative practices are actually, in many cases, responding to you know, really horrific practices in the dominant paradigm.
And I would also really start, if you prefer to go, I always forget her name, that Pushed, it's pushedbirth.com, that Jennifer Block is a journalist, and that she approached this from the standpoint of kind of how I did, of you know, I'm uncertain about this. I kind of know how I feel, but I don't really know the facts. I don't really know. And so she does a really long, extensive study. And her website is full of information as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like one of those kind of muckrakey books that have been coming out lately about issues like food, Michael Pollan.
Pointing out things that people don't
Right.
People think they know, and that's part of why it makes me sad, because I feel like we have all been duped, mm-hmm. you know, into thinking that things are one way when it turns out that they're not. And then we suffer for it, and our babies suffer for it, and our bodies suffer for it, and that seems just terrible and unnecessary.
Well, I agree, and that's why I wanted to do a show about this. And I've learned a lot from just the stuff that you've brought up. You know, at dinner, you're like, "Oh, I read this today," and it's just blown my mind. It's things that I've never really thought about. And again, I think of myself as a political person. Not only that, a political person, but someone who, you know, is constantly looking for the way that politics intersects with body. And the fact that I miss this, and the fact that I feel like I need to take childbirth on board, and just the kind of general sense of knowing that this is a vital place to understand where the system intrudes on women's bodies in really profound and disturbing ways.
Yeah.
And that the hospital, as a great a place it can be in terms of the overall the overall health of a society, the hospital is not the go-to place for a variety of reasons.
For a normal physiological process,
and I think that
right?
it's best to underline, you know, the main idea here, which is that the hospital is great when you're really sick. And I wouldn't even say that it's great, but it's a place to go, maybe an appropriate place to go when you're undergoing an extreme medical trauma. But childbirth is not a medical trauma. Childbirth is a normal physiological process,
yes.
And one
in
that
most cases,
with
yes.
with care and with love, can be done at home. Yeah. Most cases.
Yeah, in most cases, that's the thing. Is that it is? It doesn't. Sometimes it's a medical issue, but most of the times it's not. For most women, in most cases, it is not a medical issue. And speaking of medical trauma. I would just like to point out that having a cesarean, because we've been talking a little bit about that, is a major medical surgery. It is a major abdominal trauma. And it's one
it
of the
seems f- like it.
And it's one of the few that a person can request outside of things like plastic surgery or breast implants. Cesarean is something that women can ask for. We know women who have no immediate obvious medical reason to have a cesarean, but who request cesarean as opposed to. And a cesarean is really, it is literally technically a major surgery, mm-hmm. with a long recovery period and an actually quite painful recovery period.
And so speaking of cesarean, I have the etymology here, and it's worth sharing, because I think listeners of Topical Fever can come to expect a certain level of morbidity. And so let's get the daily morbid fact out. The word cesarean comes from a practice in Rome, obviously. which required the child of a mother dead in childbirth to be cut from her womb before she was buried. Oh. It was a religious requirement that mothers not be buried pregnant, and has evolved eventually into a way of saving the fetus, with the Roman practice eventually referring to it as a cesarean. And the rumor was that once this became a practice of actually giving birth, and the rumor was that Caesar himself had been born this way, but that's not true. That's right. an urban legend. But either way, fascinating etymology is that it was
that's awful.
Is that it was never the practice of cesarean was designed to be done on a dead woman. Ugh. It was not. In other words, it was never designed to actually be a way of extracting a live fetus from a live woman.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, there's Topical Fever for the day. I want to thank Claudia for joining us. I know that Claudia reads a ton, way more than I read. It's actually sickening how much she reads. And I know she'll be back again to talk about all sorts of topics. Thank you, Claudia.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Okay, thanks for listening to Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons. I want to thank my guest, Claudia Moreno-Pisano, for contributing to such a great conversation about childbirth. We have shows coming up very soon in the future that include topics like Iran, David Foster Wallace, climate change, and all sorts of other fun stuff. So thanks for listening to Topical Fever.